Beckerman and Bond were able to realize their vision of making a predicated set theory suffice. And then we were called Parsons in a combination of substitutional and objectual quantification. That would still not be nominalism, as I said, that it would certainly soothe the nominalistic spirit. I'm not counting on it. We do have a linguistic term on this, foreshadowed already by John Warren Tilke, if not possibly in Lindelbach and other medievals. We no longer accord an explanatory value to the idea of ideas. I think of Jean Poiré as a favorite classic. Poiré is where you might say classes finished with ideas. I traffic in extensional objects, concrete and abstract. What one hopes to accomplish in talking of ideas, I would hope to accomplish in talking of language. And yet, paradoxically, it's in talking of language that one is most tempted to talk also of ideas. Language is for communicating ideas, people say. Language evidently is artificial telepathy, for want of the real thing, an ingenious device. In learning a word, we associate it with the same idea as the people associated with from whom we learned the word, and then to communicate the idea to someone, we say the word, so he can hear it and conjures up the same idea that we had in mind. How do we know that's happening? It seems like telepathy after all. Consider what really happens. We learn two words by hearing them. Hearing them defined in other words, perhaps. Or by ostension. Or sometimes we pick them up from context and make a guess as to how else to use them, pursuing analogies. The basic way, of course, is ostension, the presence of the objects to which they refer, if they refer to objects, or by hearing whole sentences, short reports on the reported occasions. Reports that are made on the very occasion that they are reported. These objects of reference, or these reported occurrences that were out there for joint observation, and ideas are not. Language is publicly learned, and the matching of ideas is as may be. Public use of words on public occasions is all we have to go on, and all that matters to language. Mostly the idea enters in discussion of language under the name of meaning. Meanings are ideas wed into words. Meaning is, most of meaning is the idea relativized. You speak of the meaning of a word or a sentence. The meaning of an expression is the idea that the expression expresses. That's the idea. What I'm definitely urging then is the paradox that meaning has no place in a theory of language. Well, the observable use of words would be all right. Use is the thing, certainly. Whatever we do about the word meaning. Dewey, in 1925, John Dewey, wrote, meaning is primarily a property of behavior. And Wittgenstein, in his later writings, pressed the point that meaning is use of words. People also speak of the things denoted by a word, or the things designated by a word, as their meanings. But that's not what I'm talking about. Meanings aren't limited even to terms. It's terms that denote or designate. And furthermore, even terms, and terms that refer to the same things. General terms that denote the same things, speaking terms that designate the same things, still may or may not have the same meaning. And Frege's a familiar example of the morning star and the evening star illustrates that. These refer to the same thing, the planet Venus, but have Frege are just different meanings. Russell's example, Scott, the name Scott, and the description that the author gave, same reference, that is to say, in this case, the same object is designated, Sir Walter Scott, but the two expressions have different meanings. Meaning is use, but this only categorizes it, it doesn't define it. Two expressions may presumably agree in meaning, whatever that is, but they can't totally agree in use. Because if you use one, you're not using the other. Use of one excludes the use of the other. I can't say the two terms in chorus. I can't write them legibly one on top of the other. Expressions are alike in meaning when they're used alike in relevant respects. And relevance is the whole problem. Two expressions might serve a present purpose equally, but unconsciously the choice is made, the use doesn't coincide exactly, the choice is made for some irrelevant reason. Often we don't know it. The choice is made unconsciously. Both expressions are equally familiar to us. Of Scott and Oliver Waverly, for instance, it might be we use one word rather than another that would serve equally well because there's a lingering echo of a somewhat a similar sound in a previous utterance. It's a question of sameness of use in relevant respects. We can narrow the problem down, the problem of meaning or sameness of meaning, by seeking cognitive meaning. So, not aspiring to such refinements as poetic meaning, meaning of connotations and how meaning it does, meaning including the associations that are conjured up by the use of that word rather than another word to the same, with the same reference. Cognitive meaning is meaning relevant to belief. Well, so this turns it into sentences. Sentences are better involved in belief. So back the same point that was so prominently urged by Jeremy Bentham in his theory of fictions, sentences becoming the primary vehicle of meaning. For that matter, it corresponds even to the origin of language. The origins of language in the cries, the signals, on the part of apes or birds or other animals. which they can be thought of as the precursors of observation sentences. So we would hope that to get meanings of words, meanings of terms from meanings of sentences by substitutivity. That is, it's a question of explaining when two words have the same meaning, two terms have the same meaning. We might explain that by saying that if you put yourself in the one term for the other in a sentence, the resulting sentence will still have the same old meaning. So that's how we might hope to get meaning of terms if we want to cognitive meaning of sentences. So then the question is, when are sentences cognitively equivalent? So that we can think of them as having the same cognitive meaning. When are sentences cognitively synonymous? Before I get to speak, when you believe both know, that's too broad. We can make use here then of what John Stuart Mill called concomitant variation. We can do that by exploiting occasion sentences, sentences which are true on one occasion plus on another. There's more than that, then you might say two sentences are two occasion sentences, like it's raining, or it's not necessarily observation sentences, it could be an occasion sentence like he's a bachelor, that's not an observation sentence, he's not very community. It takes additional information, some people will have it, and others won't. Other occasion sentences that aren't observational even for the individual. That's going to explode, for instance. If two occasional sentences of that sort are accepted, are affirmed, are assented to, are believed on just the same occasions as believed on others by the given individual, that would be a good basis for saying that they have the same cognitive meaning for him. Of course, for occasional sentences and not for standing sentences, which are believed not on a particular occasion, but right along with it all. So, same verdict in same circumstances, that would be a test. Circumstances, what are they? Well, same stimulations, or sufficiently similar. Similar now in the sense of receptive rather than perceptive. I mean, receptual rather than perceptual similarity. So we're back to stimulus synonymy. But it's not a question not merely of stimulus synonymy of observation sentences, but stimulus synonymy of occasion sentences. He's a bachelor. He's an unmarried man. These two certainly are cognitively equivalent. They would be assented to, if at all, in the same circumstances, by the same, by any given speaker, by any speaker of the language. They might affirm and deny them in different circumstances, depending on what they knew about the person in question and his married or not. For each of them, these two would be interchangeable. They would have the same status. Or, again, and this would be for a given individual, but not for all of them. There goes Dr. Parr. There goes John's old tutor. Somebody who happens to know that Dr. Parr is John's old tutor. For him, these two, again, would be occasion sentences with the same cognitive meaning, same stimulus meaning. But only for, not for figures generally, only for those who happen to know a bit about the facts. Primarily, that's, of course, stimulus tsunami, which is the basin that's holding here, as well as between appropriate population sequences. Stimulus tsunami applies primarily to the individual. But then we can extend it here, as in the case of observations and sentences to society, by saying that two implication sentences are stimulus synonymous, therefore continuity equivalent for society, if that pair is for each individual stimulus synonymous for him. He's a bachelor, he's an unmarried man, as the example. Cognitive equivalence or stimulus tsunami may hold between sentences for a given individual and not for society, either because of special knowledge, as in the case of Dr. Park, or because of special ignorance. That's a camel, that's a dromedary. If the person is appropriately ignorant, those two would be stimulus synonymous for him. There's a monkey, there's an ape, similarly. There's a hare, there's a rabbit. There's an alligator, there's a crocodile. That's beard, that's ale. Inflation, for lack of information, as in these cases, does not engender stimulus synonymy, therefore cognitive equivalence, at the social level, because discrimination by the more informed members of the society prevent that from being, prevent those identifications from being unanimous across society. But misconceptions of the opposite kind, positive misconceptions, do interfere. Wrongly separating sentences, occasion sentences that should be that we would like to say were stimulus synonymous for society. Will break the stimulus synonymy for society according to this definition that generalizes across the individuals. Somebody who thinks that furs and barks are different plants when they're really the same plant. People that think that newts and cats are different but they're really the same species under different names. People who think that tomatoes and tomatoes are different vegetables. These illusory distinctions obstruct the unanimity that is wanted for equivalence at the social level. So the semanticist then coped with the problem by just rounding out, disqualifying those deviant people, the ignorant people, from the membership of the society that he's considering, says, yes, these are, which is a convenient thing to do. These are cognitively equivalent or stimulus synonymous. Now moving on to the synonymy of words and phrases, synonymy, let's say, of terms. Cognitive synonymy still. By substitution, the idea would be that one term is cognitively synonymous with another. If putting the one to the other in an occasion sentence does not disturb the student's meaning of that sentence. Here, however, we find we have to disqualify many contexts. Quotation for one. Quoting somebody, quoting a sentence where he used to say that the word course. We can't substitute the word prayers, we can just quote him, in spite of their student's anonymity. Saying Scott, quotation marks, S-C-O-T-T, has five letters. We can't substitute we can't substitute the author of liberty to stop in that quotation context, but that's more than five letters. Well, these struggles, which are obvious enough to use quotation, we can simply disqualify quotation, that is not other contexts. But the trouble extends to indirect quotation as well. He said that Scott was born in Scotland or whatever. The question whether we want to quote him as saying he said that the author of Waverley is born in Scotland, particularly if we knew that he didn't know it was Scotland clearly. Certainly for other propositional attitudes and indirect quotations, certainly for he regrets that so-and-so, he hopes that so-and-so, these are in the same sort of trouble as quotation, quite acutely. So, what about synonymy of terms? Not synonymous. An example is, and this is where typically propositional attitude and come in usefully. Tom knows that the evening star is the evening star. That certainly is true. Tom knows that the evening star is the evening star. Now, if we substitute morning star for evening star in this, but substitute in just the last place, Tom knows that the evening star is the morning star, that may be false. So this context does not produce what we would want to do in that definition. Here's a case where putting what we'd like to this context does drive the wedge that we want between English and English. Similarly for Scott and the author of Waverley, Tom knows that Scott is Scott. Maybe Tom doesn't know that Scott is the author of Waverley. So this says again, as we want to do, Scott and the author of Waverley do not have the same cognitive. They're not cognitive, it's synonymous. But the trouble with this criterion is that it cuts too fine. It cuts finer than just saying it. Just a bit of the preservation of truth value, but it goes too far. It does not take a pair of real synonyms, if there are any, and the pair that one often falls back on. It's not easy to find one word pair. Is first and course again. In fact, is planned. Of course, there are no end of pairs that would be all right if one of the words is one of the terms is a single word and the other is an elaborate phrase that comes out of them. But convenient one word examples. All right, Tom believes this stuff is hers, is perhaps true. This plant. Tom believes this plant is hers, perhaps that's true. Tom believes this plant is Gore's, is perhaps false. This is not a context that would support the result that we would like to preserve, namely that Gore's and hers be, yes, cognitively synonymous, unlike morning star and evening star, unlike Scott and author Waverley. So the question is, how can we screen out examples of that kind that change the truth value under the substitution of synonyms? Well, I have no way of nothing to suggest for that. Giving up on synonymy of terms, we still do have synonymy, cognitive synonymy, cognitive equivalence of occasion sentences, namely, and stimulus synonymy of the occasion sentences. We might move on then to standing sentences. Last Wednesday, for event, I suggested defining the empirical content of a set of sentences as the class of all the observation categoricals that it implies. Some classes of sentences won't imply any observation categorical. The class that does is strong enough to imply some, I've described as having a critical semantic mass. I define the empirical content in that way, instead of all the implied observation categoricals, if such a feat. We can sharpen this definition a bit to filter out irrelevant differences that could be brought about just by, because at one point we've used some observation sentences conform to the observation categorical, and next time we use a different occasion sentence, which have happened, however, we can't be synonymous with that person. We want to screen, screen those out by saying that, by also allowing for any substitution of cognitive equivalent observation sentences one to another. And in this way, we get a definition of empirical content. And then, we might consider defining sentences, and this time not just occasion sentences, but standing sentences or sentences generally, as equivalent or synonymous, cognitively. Putting one for the other always preserves empirical content of a set of sentences. And this would seem, as far as I made out, this would seem to be all right, except that this whole notion of empirical content is a bit visionary for a couple of reasons. The chains of implication in actual science are not laid out explicitly, and for that matter, even the observation sentences themselves are bound to be vague at the edges of that problem, the question about the black swan, for instance. The cognitive equivalence of occasion sentences certainly is in best shape, and cognitive equivalent more generally standard sentences is a little more trickier, a bit more speculative. Well, we've been wondering about meaning, and so far I've been considering it in just one context, namely sameness of meaning, which is to say, synonymy. And this is a context of the term that one has no choice but to deal with, because if sameness of meaning can't be construed in general, meaning can't. There's no identity without identity, that's to say. But if we know what meanings are, we know when to say that we have the same meaning, and when to say we have two different meanings. But there are other contexts to think about. There are, as I say, three basic contexts for the term meaning. There's sameness of meaning, that's that one. And there's having